Julie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I don't even know where to begin. I was thinking about that before this, and I'm like, there's so much that I want to ask you and that we could ways we could kind of take this conversation. So I think we're just going to run with it. But one of the biggest things that's on my mind is obviously you talk a lot about creating healthy and secure attachment styles. Mm-hmm. Has that ever been normal, do you think, in human history? Or is this something that has continuously been a problem? And how do we shift towards a world that is mm-hmm. more healthfully and securely attached?
Yeah, I think that, definitely we are more insecurely attached than ever, just because, the world we live in and the priorities that we've been placing on anything that's really not kind of like emotional support, emotional connection. And I think that, anytime you have a family unit or just a parent-child relationship that has some strain in it, meaning, it could be anything from a natural disaster where the parents are stressed to depression to just poor, parenting lessons that they received growing up. If anything that you have happen that disrupts the child's sense of emotional safety is going to create a sense of insecure attachment. So if you just think, maybe 300-400 years ago, there could be different types of stressors that could create problems in families, going to war, civil war, and things like this. But the everyday, sort of way that people lived was just more emotionally supportive to begin with. And life was slower. We had more time, and so you had probably bigger, more acute threats, but they were less likely to happen. And now you just have this sort of chronic stress and chronic lack of skill. And it just keeps perpetuating through the generations. And so, yeah, I definitely think that we're at an all-time low of relationship quality.
Yeah.
Which would be the same as insecure attachment. It's all kind of the same, different ways of saying the same thing.
Right. You mentioned skill. What skills are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, the word skill can be helpful because there are actual tools that we can learn that kind of exemplify the concepts, right? But then they also have to be coming from a place of a felt sense, right? But the skills are knowing how to be emotionally supportive when your, partner or child, whoever that it is in your life that relies on you for emotional support. There are very, tangible, practical skills that you can learn to know how to respond in a way that's going to help them feel validated, held, like they matter, heard, seen. And that's what everybody's really needing right now. If you were just to kind of figure out how to put those things, validation, being heard, being seen, empathized with into a pill and, gave it to the pharmaceutical companies, I'm sure they would love that. And they would, that's what we're needing really. And that's what I'm here doing is just, that is what creates secure attachment.
Mm. And, I see on Instagram all the slew of the opposite of that, meaning you don't need validation from others type, mm-hmm. Hyper independence. Mm-hmm. What have you said, or what would you say to those people who are like, well, I don't want to be codependent, or I don't want to be mm-hmm. reliant on somebody to meet my needs or to validate me?
Sure.
What's that side of the coin? Because I would like to talk about that.
Well, it's a good, it's a healthy concern to have, right? Because, we don't want to become enmeshed and codependent. I mean, that is in and of itself insecure attachment. That is, codependency and enmeshment is what people do to substitute real intimacy when they don't actually have it, right? Mm. And know how to get it. And so, what I like to say is validation from someone else is what you need to feel close to them, not what you need to feel good about yourself necessarily. Although there are, obviously there's overlap, it helps you feel good about yourself when someone else loves and validates you. But if you just think of the most casual relationship, with like someone that you work with, if you don't feel respected and somewhat validated by that person, like they can recognize, you know, the way, validate some of the way that you see things or try to understand you and be curious about you, you're not going to feel close to them. It's just, it's, we all live by that principle, no matter what, if we like it or not, you know, we're going to be closer to people in our world that we feel like they can see us, they can understand us. And then when we have a relationship with ourself, that again, we can't entirely separate our relationship with ourself from our relationship with others. However, they are two separate things, and you can give yourself all the self-validation in the world. But if you have a partner that isn't able to help you with that, you will not be able to feel close to that partner. If you bring something up, a concern, and they say, well, you shouldn't see it that way, or you're being irrational, or, you know, you will, it's not possible to feel entirely emotionally safe and close to someone who can't provide those emotional needs for you that are relationship needs, not self needs.
I love that distinction, that the validation from others brings you closer to them.
Exactly.
And you still need about like that self-validation at the same time. Wow.
Yeah. And another thing is, if you don't have the self-validation, it will be very difficult for you to take that in from somebody else. So it is really important that you do have a healthy relationship with yourself.
Right. Yeah. When it comes to creating secure attachment, I think the relationship with yourself has a lot to do with that and your patterns. Mm-hmm. I guess, how does somebody, because we could say attachment styles and what is your attachment style, whatever, mm-hmm. no matter where they're coming from, what are the key elements of beginning to create that secure attachment first within yourself, so you have the mm-hmm. capacity to bring that to a relationship?
I think a really good way to sort of imagine a secure relationship with yourself is, you know, if you sort of break yourself into two parts, right? And you have your kind of child part, for lack of a better word, and your parent part, you know, and imagine that you are, you know, you have this emotional part of you that needs to feel safe and needs to feel secure in the world and needs to, you know, self-care and learn how to kind of function in the world in a healthy way. And then you have this parent part that's helping you do those things, right? And so, you know, helping you learn to self-regulate, helping you learn to, you know, show up for yourself in a healthy way when you're stressed or tired, and so that might look like, you know, let's say you go to work and someone at work yells, your employer yells at you, right? And so if you're a child in that situation and you have this parent part, the child part might want to just get really dysregulated and upset and lash out or go home and, you know, binge drink or any number of kind of unhealthy things, beat themselves up, say, look at me, I'm such a loser, my boss doesn't even like me, or go into this kind of extreme place of they're just a terrible person. And so that parent comes in and says, all right, let's step back here, right? Let's take some breaths. Let's self-regulate. You know, I'm right here with you. It's understandable that you're mad. You know, we don't have to go to beating yourself up. Let's figure out let me just sit with you in your feelings and let you feel what happened. And now let's sort of move into what's the best way to go about handling this situation, right? And the best way to go about handling it might be, let's sit with the feelings for a while and figure out, maybe you need to set some boundaries. Maybe you need to self-reflect on what your part in that situation may have been. But someone with an anxious attachment is going to get, you know, more kind of overwhelmed with anxiety and not handle the situation as well as they could in one way. And then someone with an avoidant attachment is not going to handle the situation well in another way, which might be, oh, just forget about it, stuff it away, don't worry about it, don't think about it, you know, don't get involved in conflict. And mm-hmm. so really, if, you know, to kind of summarize all of that, the healthy attachment with self is, how do you show up for yourself when you're in distress? Do you validate yourself? Do you self-reflect? Do you try to work on self-regulation and how you respond to the stresses in life? What is your self-care like? Do you treat your body with respect and care? You know, do you treat your emotions with respect and care? And so it's, I guess, you know, some people don't like the idea of the parent-child idea, but I like it because, you know, secure attachment originates from a parent-child relationship. So it's the good enough parent, not a perfect parent, but it's a good enough parent that is helping the child learn to manage all these big feelings and function in the world and self-care and these things. So if you miss out on that, you really do. This, it really is a reparenting process.
Right. And I think that's the beautiful distinction to have that separation of those parts. Mm-hmm. Where does it come in? And I'm sure just general compassion and not taking on shame, because as you're learning this stuff, if you've lived a certain mm-hmm. way for so long and then you catch it and beat yourself up because you didn't respond in a healthy way, or maybe you judge your partner or even somebody else because mm-hmm. they didn't respond in a healthy way of like what should mm-hmm. be. I just think that has a really big part to play in the healing of mm-hmm. all of this.
Yeah, I mean, shame can really get in the way of healing if you know, shame can be very dysregulating, or it can cause us to just kind of want to avoid change altogether because we don't want to mess up and then experience shame. So are you asking me kind of how do you manage that shame in a way that doesn't block your growth?
Yeah, that and also like, why do we shame ourselves, and what would be a better route to take, or when you recognize that it's happening?
Well, we shame ourselves because we learn to shame ourselves from being shamed, right? And we're not born with shame. We get messages that, you know, this part of you is unacceptable. This mm-hmm. part of you that gets angry is unacceptable. Go in your room to be angry. This part of you, when you're a kid and it gets really mad and wants to throw a toy, is unacceptable. Now, we all understand that behavior of throwing the toy is an unacceptable behavior. But the problem is the child gets the message, you're unacceptable for being mad. And so, you know, there is something to be said for shame, you know, a healthy version of shame or a healthy guilt. You know, we all need to know how to be, you know, not sociopaths,
civil, for lack of better. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, but what happens is, you know, in an environment that's just really, really over the top with shame, which are many, many of us are growing up in that because we all have so much shame. I mean, it's really difficult to not dump your shame onto your kids if you're carrying a lot of it yourself. So, and so what happens is that you get these messages, all or parts of you are unacceptable. And then what do you have to do? You have to start hiding those parts. And you don't want to face them. I mean, that shame is one of the most painful experiences that people can feel. And so, you know, what you have to do first is you have to stop treating yourself with shame. And the antidote to shame is acceptance. And the antidote to shame is validation, which is also acceptance. And so it's kind of like, look, I wasn't my best self today. I yelled at my kids. I yelled at my partner. I don't like that. That's not who I want to be in the world. There's value in learning to grow out of that. But I come by this honestly because that's how I learned to navigate the world. I'm still learning about better ways to be and to function in my relationship. And, you know, sitting here beating myself up is just part of the problem. So maybe I just need to sit with some healthy guilt, but also balance that out with, I'm good. I'm lovable. I'm learning. That's all. What we're all here to do is learn. You know, there's just no way around that. And then make repairs, and, you know, try not to get sucked into that shame spiral place that really isn't, you know, it's just not productive to go there.
Right.
Or to stay there. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious in your studies and diving deep into all of this work, what has really stood out to you or really been an aha moment for you, either personally or just like, whoa, like this solved the Rubik's Cube of the thing that I was trying to figure out mm-hmm. with a client or with yourself?
Honestly, and maybe this is why I kind of try to drive this point home so dramatically. For me, just this validation piece of interactions was a real game changer. Just, you know, I grew up in an environment where we just were constantly moving away from each other. If you say X, I'm going to say Y. If you say the sky is blue, I'm going to say it's a light shade of purple. If you say you feel angry, I'm going to say, well, look at all the things to be not angry about. If you say I'm sad, well, you need to think of all the reasons to be happy. If you say you're happy, well, don't get too happy. Good things might go away. And so when you really just allow yourself to sit with a person, another person's experience, you know, I'm always thinking in the context of my three closest relationships, which is my husband, my children, and my clients I work with. And when you just take the time to just sit with that and say, yeah, I really get it. It makes so much sense to me that you're mad about this. Even if they're mad at you, even if you don't agree with why they're mad at you, even if you don't agree that you were, you know, trying to be snarky when you made that comment, it's okay just to sit with someone and say, I get it. If I thought you were being snarky to me, I would be mad too. And it's a really magical what can happen when you shift out of, you know, this place where we're just constantly trying to convince each other to think or see things differently. And that really is what opens people up to shifting their feelings or their thoughts, if that's going to happen.
Yeah. And what does it take for somebody to start to shift, make that shift and be open and sit with somebody else's emotions without trying to change it or be defensive? And
I think the first step is just being aware that you're doing it and it kind of trying to understand why you're doing it. You know, if, you know, my, let's, you know, just throwing an example out there. If my husband thinks that I said something sarcastic and really I wasn't trying to be sarcastic and he gets upset, and then maybe I want to go in and say, look at you, you're just interpreting me in the worst way possible. You know, you're reading it wrong. This is your stuff because your dad was always so sarcastic. And that's just going to make him want to like him not feel seen and understood and validated for whatever his wound was, which he could have communicated in this situation in a better way possible. I mean, in a better way anyway, but let's say that didn't happen. And so he's just going to double down. People want to double down when they don't feel seen and heard. And if I can kind of recognize and go, okay, what's happening for me right now? Like, why am I needing to convince him of something else? And we're all needing to do that for different reasons. I mean, usually there are only a few different reasons. We're all human and, you know, we're all trying to convince people we're safe and good. And, but with that said, you know, everybody has a reason. Everybody has a really good reason for getting defensive. And that reason in that situation for me might be, I don't want to be the bad guy. I don't want to think I'm not trusted. I don't want to, you know, feel like I'm not being understood. And so what I'm going to try to do, you know, that feels so bad inside to not feel seen or to be put in this box of the bad guy when I don't feel like I'm the bad guy. And, that starts dipping into my old wounds around, you know, am I even like, you know, a lovable person or whatever? I'm just kind of speaking hypothetically here. Mm-hmm. And so it feels really bad. You get this kind of like icky feeling inside, right? And so then what you want to do is you want to go in and go, I'm going to try to get you to see it differently. Because if I can get you to see it differently and understand that this is actually really your problem, you're interpreting it in the wrong way or all of these things, then you'll get it and you won't see me as being sarcastic. And then you'll see it differently and then I'll be safe and you'll be safe and everybody will be okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. So kind of catching that and really either with therapy or just learning, you know, how to explore yourself and understand what am I going for here? And then go, is there value in another approach? And the value in the other approach is, okay, I think we might be missing each other. You know, I'm right here. That's a kind of a co-regulating approach, which is something really important just happened for you. Or, you know what? I get it. I get why that would upset you. If you think I'm, you know, just kind of being flippant and sarcastic with you, I get why that would hurt your heart. And kind of settle it, create some emotional safety, and then maybe come in and say, you know, here's what was happening for me. That really wasn't where I was coming from. you know, we don't want to, I'm never trying to get people to completely abandon their own needs and their own perspectives, but it's just about, you know, creating some emotional safety first, because nobody's open when there's no emotional safety. Right. Yeah, I feel like I'm right. kind of all over the place, but I hope you're.
That made sense. That made sense okay. to me. Yeah. Okay, no, creating emotional safety, and that's validating the other person's experience before going in yeah. and trying to control it or change it. And
exactly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you were saying that towards the end, I was like, and that's where the parent-child dynamic internally, I feel mm-hmm. like can really support, because you're doing that with yourself. So you'll catch it when you're doing it with other people, or it happens with other people.
Exactly. Yeah. And some people, like, I just thought of this. Some people would prefer like the term your wise mind, instead of thinking of yourself as like a parent and a child. Some people that sits better with them. Your wise mind is coming in to sort of guide you. Or some people think of it as a spiritual presence, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. When it comes to, let's talk a little bit about the dance of anxious and avoidant relationships. What really, you know, somebody's anxious and they're in a relationship with somebody who's avoidant. More often than not, at least been my experience, that the anxious person is the one coming to me for help. And mm-hmm. how do you navigate that? How mm-hmm. personally, what advice would you give to somebody in that situation? Nate, let's talk to the anxious person first.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, because, you know, what I like to say is that the hardest part of working with an avoidant partner is getting them through the door. But then the hardest part of working with an anxious partner is what happens when they are through the door. You know, it's hard for them to kind of get out of that blame, you're at fault place. Because it can really, on the surface, it really can appear that the avoidant partner is more of the problem, but they're not. And so it is tricky. It is really tricky when you only have the anxious partner to work with. Mm-hmm. But so what I say in that situation is, look, we don't have your avoidant partner here for whatever reason. You know, coming in and doing couples therapy isn't safe for them right now. There's a good reason they're resistant to it. I don't know what that reason is, but right now let's just sort of try to honor that. And what can we do on your side of the street to help you add emotional safety into your relationship? Is that fair? No, maybe not. Is it hard? Absolutely. But there's value in it, because you can, on your own, start shifting the emotional climate of a relationship. Now, you cannot create a healthy connection without the other person participating in that process, right? But you can create an environment that is going to increase the odds that both people will start to grow toward that. And if that's not happening, you know, let's say, worst case scenario, one person saying, look, I'm doing everything and I can. I'm learning better ways to bring up problems. I'm learning healthier ways to respond to my partner. I'm learning healthier ways to, you know, just speak to them in an everyday kind of way. And nothing's changing. They're still, you know, I'm still over here feeling demoralized, alone, you know, like not fulfilled in the relationship. Then we go into a different conversation. But if really someone's goal is, I want a better relationship, that's the first place to start. And it is the first place to start no matter what. If both partners are in the room with me as a couples therapist, still everybody has to focus on their side of the street. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of work that can be done by one partner alone, but it can't go on like that indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. For the... what is it that somebody who is avoidant needs to come to more sense mm-hmm. of secure attachment?
The first thing that the avoidant partner needs to do is to learn how to emotionally engage with themselves. There's no way that an avoidant partner can really fully help their anxious partner in their pain until they start to get really in touch with their own. And get in touch with their emotions, meaning first, you know, learning to just recognize their emotions on a physical level, put words to those feelings. Are you there? I feel like you might have frozen up.
No, we're good.
Okay, you're there. Yeah. Okay. And learn to share, right? And learn to figure out, you know, like a lot of times what avoidant partners are doing with their emotional experiences that they aren't really consciously aware of is they're trying to, well, just fix the world around me, just, you know, be productive, be somehow avoid pain by doing and fixing problems, problem solving mode, at the expense of really kind of sitting with their feelings and learning more about that part of them. And so what happens is when the anxious partner starts bringing their emotional needs to the relationship, and what is the avoidant partner going to do? Try to soothe them and comfort them in the same way that they deal with their own emotions, which is fix it, minimize it, stuff it away, get defensive. And so the first thing that that avoidant partner needs to do is learn how to, one, help themselves in these places without going into those, you know, habitual moves, and then help the anxious partner in their dark places. But there's a really, really big piece that's number three, and it's hugely important. And that is let the anxious partner in to help them. Mm. And what happens is the anxious partner will never feel filled up and fully connected if they aren't able to get in and help the avoidant partner with their feelings. And the anxious partner doesn't know how to do that to begin with, right? So we get this narrative going with an anxious avoidant partner that the anxious partner has all the emotional needs. And if only the avoidant partner could learn to show up and meet the anxious partner's emotional needs, everything would be great. But we're missing this piece that it needs to be balanced and reciprocated, that the avoidant partner has just as many emotional needs that they need help with. Mm-hmm. And if we had that avoidant partner supporting the anxious partner's emotional needs as, you know, as perfectly as possible, the anxious partner, both of them are still going to feel like something's missing if we don't get that going the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the ownership, really. Like, I love the terminology you used of mm-hmm. like, stay on your side of the street. I love that.
Yeah.
When there's age old question, I'm sure you've been asked it on social media, or at least once in a session. Of mm-hmm. when do you know to call quits? And the flip side of that, I guess, right after, I would like to know, you know, when do you know of that somebody is the one?
Well, first I'll just say this: you never know 100%. I mean, you know, sometimes we just have to do the best with what we have, the information that we have. So I think if people are kind of looking for 100% certainty, they're going to be disappointed. And so we have to look for, you know what, good enough decision, right? This is the information I have. I'm going to do the best with it that I can. So when do you know it's time to call it quits? You know, every situation is different, and it's hard for me to give some kind of a generalized answer, but I will anyway, because, so the generalized answer is, if you really believe that you've been doing everything that you can on your part, to your capability, to the information that you have, you know, accessible to you, and that you are, you know, you're really working toward becoming your best self. Not perfect, but you really have put in the effort. And things just really still aren't shifting. You're feeling better maybe about yourself and in your own life, but you're level of fulfillment in the relationship is low. You still don't feel close. You're still carrying a lot of anger and resentment. And then the third thing is, if you just don't have a whole lot of hope that things will ever change, it's that hopeless piece, right? It's like, we can deal with the first two. All right, I can keep going. I can keep really trying to work on myself here. And yeah, I'm not seeing a lot of results or the results that I need, but I still have some hope because I still see that things are starting to shift. We could keep going, but if we're going, you know what, it doesn't seem like that this rate, it's going to ever really get much better. That's the time to really decide what to do going forward. And ending it doesn't always mean physically separating. You know, some people don't have that as a real viable option. They have a family or a financial situation. So sometimes ending it is just sort of emotionally detaching and no longer having the same expectations, accepting what is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to know it's the one, that is, you know, what is your felt sense most of the time when you're interacting with the other person? Do you feel seen? Do you feel heard? Do you have physical attraction? Do you have, you know, compatibility? Do you have the same basic value system? And mm-hmm. I think what is missing a lot of the time is that people have these, you know, kind of checklists that are important. You know, we both want the same things out of life, and we both want a family, and we both want to live in the city, and, or we both want to live off the grid, but they're missing that. Do we really feel this sense of connection when we're together? And that sense of connection can sound kind of vague, right? Like, what is a sense of connection? Well, a sense of connection, this is when we kind of move into those actual like kind of skills, is, do I feel emotionally validated? Do I feel accepted for who I am, even though I have room to grow? Do I feel heard and understood a lot of the time? Do I feel like my needs really matter to this person?
Mm-hmm. With those, this might be a tricky question, but like, how do you know if it's your own stuff, so to speak, of my needs aren't being met, or see, mm-hmm. this person doesn't care, like looking for it because it's mm-hmm. happened before, versus that's actually what's in mm-hmm. your current relationship dynamic?
Yeah, that can be tough, for sure. I think that, you know, if you have an anxious attachment, you're maybe going to err toward what I call filtering for the negative, meaning your nervous system was wired either in your childhood or maybe in another really impactful adult relationship. Your nervous system was wired to believe that, you know, all good things are going to go away, or there's not really, this person really isn't predictably available to me. And so you start being more hypervigilant to what's going wrong and miss what's going right. So if you can, you know, kind of recognize and relate to that, you might want to be able to step back. I think gratitude lists can be really helpful. If you feel like, you know, if someone feels like they have a tendency to kind of get stuck in that negative, what's not working. But so when I am working with a couple, I'm always figuring out, okay, there's a block here, and working backwards. And what's the source of this block for each partner? And, you know, let's say the block is that they start arguing, you know, about money, right? And they both have all of these, you know, what happens is it's no longer about money when they get into a negative cycle, but it starts to become about relationship needs, attachment needs. Do I matter to you? Am I being heard here? You know, am I feeling blamed for everything? Am I feeling appreciated for what I am getting right? And so I'm going to work backwards from there, and I'm going to say, all right, what about partner A is kind of what I call an intrapsychic issue, meaning is about them and their past and their own personal blocks. And what is about this is a part of the relationship blocks that they've co-created together. And it just, you know, it's a process of just learning to explore yourself and really kind of step back and figure out, you know, what is going on with me here? Mm-hmm. What about this moment? You know, when I hear my partner say, you're horrible with money, what's going on with me? What about my past is making that exponentially more painful to hear? And what about the fact that it's a reality in this moment and it's really painful to hear? Kind of being able to, you know, parcel it all out in the service of being able to talk about it.
Right. Just fully getting a grip on your internal experience. Really, like what all is mm-hmm. present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you might find, you know, I'd need to do some work around my own shame and my own sort of sensitivity to criticism. And I might need to do some communication work with my partner. Like, hey, that doesn't feel good for me when you say that. and maybe, but probably both. It's almost always some of both, right?
Right. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, I know you've got a book coming out very soon. You mind talking a little bit more about that?
Sure. So this book is called Secure Love, and I do a type of therapy called emotion-focused therapy for couples, which uses attachment theory to help couples go from insecure attachment to secure attachment. And so what I tried to do with this book is I tried to kind of create a self-help version of the process that I use with a couple of, you know, my private practice. So I start off with just really diving into what attachment theory is, the different styles. I think I have a very, as a couples therapist who uses attachment theory, I think I have a very unique window into how this stuff is really showing up in very nuanced ways in relationships. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that I've become so popular on Instagram is because I can kind of take it to a different level as far as romantic relationships go. And so I kind of dive into that, say, hey, look, this is, you know, potentially what your childhood looked like if you have an anxious attachment. And here's some of the ways it's going to be showing up in your relationship or future relationship if you're single. Then we go into the negative cycle, which is the communication, you know, repetitive patterns that couples get stuck in, where it's kind of like this habitual blame, defend, invalidate, escalate, very, you know, consistent patterns among not just the couple, but couples in general. And then we go into how, when you recognize you're in this negative cycle, how can you interrupt it? How can we create an environment that will prevent them? And how can we learn to repair them? And part of that big picture is all of these skills I'm talking about, creating what I call this attachment-friendly environment, which is more or less how you're communicating with each other. And then after that, I talk about different issues and how attachment relates to these issues, some mental illness, sex. And then after that, I have a whole chapter on scripts. People love scripts. They don't just want concepts. They want words. And my hope is that you'll take these words that I've tried to write in kind of the most neutral way possible and make them their own. And yeah, so I think it's amazing. I do. I'm really excited. If my Instagram has been really popular, so I think if you were to take all the information on my Instagram and make it linear and more organized, that would be the book.
Amazing. Yeah, that sounds very like complete. I like he covered as much as possible in that book. And especially
I hope so.
With the, especially with the scripts, I'm excited to see that as well, because I think that sometimes it's just like, well, I don't know. Cool. Got the concept, but still how do I apply
exactly.
it? Right.
Yeah.
And so I could imagine that that'd be really helpful for people. What sparked
I think so.
The
idea? I needed that.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think we got a lag. I was saying, what sparked the idea for the book?
Oh, well, I started this Instagram account. I didn't really have any intention of, you know, it going anywhere. I just had a clinic and here where I live, and my bookkeeper was like, you should go start an Instagram account. It's kind of like people use it as Google or whatever. And so I started it, and then I realized, oh, well, I got to put something on here. You know, and I wasn't really even sure how Instagram worked. This was during COVID. And so I thought, well, I know a lot about attachment theory. That's my specialty. So I just started drawing little cartoons and to help people learn. And it just started blowing up. And then I, you know, evolved from there. And then about, I would say 3 or 4 months into the process, people started saying, you need to write a book. You need to write a book. And so I was just going to, say, okay, I'm just going to kind of bring together what I know, organize it, you know, make it linear and give it out to people, like just a self-published type of thing, one and done. I kind of thought it would take like a month. And so after about 2 weeks of working on it, I was like, this is incredibly hard. Like, this is a lot, you know, this is really hard. And I went out on the front porch and my husband was out there And I said, there's no way I have the ability or time to write this book. Not so much the ability, but just my life. I mean, I have 6 kids, and at the time, you know, they're all in high school or below. And he looked at me, and my husband's the one in our relationship that's always really trying to pull me back. You know, I have a tendency to just charge and go and not really think about, you know, the consequences all the time. And he looked at me and he said, you have to write this book. You have to write it. And which was completely out of our usual narrative. And so I thought, Wow. Well, yeah, then I have to write the book. Like, if he's saying I have to write the book. And so that was, you know, again, I thought, okay, it'll take, you know, a month, 6 months. I don't know. I'm just going to sit down and get it done really quickly. And then it evolved from there to selling it to publishing company. And then that was, 3.5 years ago. So wow. It took me full 3 years to get it written. So,
wow. You know, it was definitely a labor of love then.
It was. I put everything I had into that book. So if it helps some people, then that will be amazing.
Awesome. And where can people find out more about it?
Well, you can go onto my Instagram, which is at The Secure Relationship, or you can find it really anywhere books are sold. I mean, it's being translated into many, many different languages. It's all the Amazons all over the world. You can pre-order it. Barnes and Noble, all the major retailers. And then my Instagram, of course, you can find more about it there.
So, amazing. Yeah. That's very exciting. And I love that story as well. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I'm curious if you're open, to sharing about your dynamic with your husband and how y'all met and how y'all created your own secure relationship.
So, you know, it's funny. Are you familiar with Gabor Mate or Gabor Mate? I'm not sure.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I'm reading one of his books right now, and he's describing his relationship and how it's evolved. And I was like, oh my God, this sounds exactly like us. Like, wow. But anyway, so he grew up in a loud Italian family with, you know, he was the 11th of 13 kids. And I grew up in this really kind of emotionally stifled environment that was, and so we just, you know, the way that we communicated was so different. He would get, he's more of that, you know, in the past, he was more of that avoidant attachment. And I was more of the anxious attachment. But we were a little bit different in the fact that I was more of a reserved anxious partner. And he was more of an escalated avoidant partner. He was still really out of touch with his feelings and defensive and didn't want to talk about relationship problems. And I was still the one pushing for all of that. But his just way of kind of being and expressing himself was always like super, super triggering for me. And I mean, it's kind of a blur. We had our first son a year after we were married. And then we had a lot of, we had 6 kids in 10 years and just a ton of trauma in there, like death of his mother and, you know, kids in the hospital sick and just all sorts of things. And so it was like that first 10-year period was really just blurry and not good communication. We always have loved each other and been very passionate with each other, but just a lot of emotional needs not going met on both sides. And my narrative was that it's him because I was that more anxious partner. And now that I look back, I realize I wasn't emotionally available to him either. You know, it was both of us that were playing into this. Neither of us had a clue what to do. So we would just get in a lot of, you know, escalated arguments, like pretty much all the couples I treat. And then we would make up and love each other so much. Our love would overcome those arguments. And then we would, you know, everything would be fine. And then the next thing you know, we have a disagreement. And the way we're talking about that disagreement starts to be really emotionally unsupportive. And that starts to create another layer of the argument. And the next thing you know, we're trying to argue about money or help around the house. And now the layer over that is attachment security and emotional, you know, dropping each other. And so you don't even know where you're going at that point. You know, it's just like the arguments are about everything on the table. There's no, you know, path. You're just all over the place. Nothing gets resolved. And then you hate fighting. You hate being disconnected. So you come back and you say, oh, we're never going to do this again. You know, we're going to learn now. And then I went back to grad school. I just had this drive in me to understand relationships, like just the most intense drive, not just in, with my partner, but with my kids. And I started learning immediately. I latched onto attachment theory, and everything started to really make sense. And then that second 10 years was a lot of working on it, just a lot of being able to see it. You know, we didn't have access to a really good therapist. It's really hard to find a good therapist, to be honest with you, even when you are one. And a lot of it, we're just kind of picking through on our own, a lot of trial and error. And then about 3 years ago, it just really all started to click. And so it was like 10 years of a lot of chaos, but love, 10 years of a lot of love and trying to work it through, still not perfectly, but things getting better. And then now 3 years in, I feel like we really have a really good grip on our relationship. You know, I feel like we're really emotionally supportive of each other. It's not perfect by any stretch, but we know how to rupture and come back and repair. And I'm just really looking forward to, you know, a few more decades of really good.
That's amazing. And
thank you.
It really seems like the sheer volume of just the 10 years of working on it is what kind of got you to this foundation you've been in the past 3 years. Like, it doesn't seem like there wasn't a light switch flipped on that was like, oh, now it's all good. Like,
no.
Yeah.
No. But also, I didn't have the access to information, I think, that people have now. Like, I would like to think, had I had access to my own Instagram, I would have, that process would have been a bit faster.
Or your book.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I'm doing this. I'm like, I wish that everything I put out there, I wish I would have had myself. So I had it from the therapist perspective, but I didn't have it from the consumer perspective.
And what was the difference? What was the shift in that?
Oh, the difference is the therapist perspective is like you're using it to help other people. The consumer perspective is you're using it to help yourself. And it's very different because you're embedded in it emotionally when you're using it to help yourself. When you're using it as a therapist, you're emotionally separated from it because the stakes aren't as high. It's just so much easier, you know?
Yeah. You're observing it, learning the tools, learning about it all versus like confronting and embodying and being self-reflective and
beautifully put. Yeah.
Yeah. That really is the work. Well, I'm excited to read your book, and for everybody listening, I hope that you're excited as well, especially after this podcast. Julie, it's been an absolute honor and a pleasure. And this was an amazing conversation. Just thank you so much for being yourself, putting in the work, sharing your story and sharing your wisdom, honestly.
Well, you're really, really welcome. Thank you.